Mr. Troia, good morning to you.
Good morning. Okay, please the court, Mr. Lowe. My name is Jason Troia, and I represent the interests of Mr. Sidgett, the appellant in this matter. This case was here just a few years ago on a direct appeal. Mr. Sidgett entered a no contest plea. He was originally charged with first-degree sexual assault. A plea bargain was reached with his trial counsel. The charges were reduced from a Class 2 felony to a Class 3 felony. The charge was amended to sexual assault second degree. That was the basis for, or that was the reduction from classification. So he received the benefit from going from being exposed to 50 years to being exposed to 20 years on the maximum end. As part of the plea agreement, the state agreed to remain silent. A different representative from the county attorney's office was present at the sentencing hearing and did more than remain silent. The county attorney mentioned two things about the pre-sentence investigation. He mentioned that the state's position was contained within the pre-sentence investigation and that he would submit it on the pre-sentence investigation.
And what was the recommendation in the pre-sentence investigation?
The probation officer that completed the pre-sentence investigation found that Mr. Sidgett was not an appropriate candidate for probation and recommended a substantial jail sentence or prison sentence.
And that's where the rub is.
Yes. Defense counsel at the time the state made its comments at sentencing did not object. Mr. Sidgett appealed. He received 18 to 20-year sentence. He appealed. He had different counsel on appeal. He raised the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel and plain error with regard to the state's breach of the plea agreement. This court found that it was not plain error. This court found that the record was insufficient to determine if it was ineffective assistance of counsel. This court found that there was a material breach of the plea agreement. This court found that there was prejudice in that the bargain struck in the plea negotiation was not protected at the time of the sentencing hearing. This court left open whether or not it was trial strategy. And so it was determined that the record was insufficient to find ineffective assistance of counsel. Mr. Sidgett proceeded with a petition for post-conviction relief. He was granted an evidentiary hearing. At the evidentiary hearing, it primarily consisted of the bill of exceptions being offered into the record. It consisted of a judicial notice of the transcripts from the case. The defense counsel or trial counsel had been deposed, and so that deposition was offered. And also there were some stipulations that were read into the record. One of the primary ones being that Mr. Sidgett, there was a stipulation that Mr. Sidgett would have chosen the option of having a new sentencing hearing in front of a different district court judge.
That would be specific performance.
Exactly. That was my next sentence. The district court...
Counsel, just to be clear, the record does not show at all that the trial judge at the time of the what this court held was a material breach, recognized it as such, or did anything to try to remedy that problem, correct?
That is correct. Either it went unnoticed by the district court or the district court felt as trial counsel testified in his deposition that he did not feel it was a material breach.
Is there anything in the record that trial counsel conceded or acknowledged that he wasn't aware that specific performance could have been requested?
Exactly. When trial counsel was deposed, he was asked about that. Why didn't you object? And he tried to have it both ways. He said, well, I didn't object because I didn't feel it to be a material breach. It's common for prosecutors to submit on the PSI. And he wanted to have it the other way by saying, well, but it was also trial strategy, because if I had objected, the only remedy would have been withdrawing the plea, and now my client would have been facing a 1 to 50 instead of a 1 to 20.
And your position is that's a mistake of law.
Yes, that's my position. And he was specifically asked in his deposition, did you understand that to be the only option? And he said, yes. So he was not aware that there was, I'll call it a third choice. Choice number one, do nothing. Choice number two, raise an objection and ask for a withdrawal of plea. Or choice number three, ask for specific performance. He was not aware of that option. I think this court could find, as a matter of law, that that's where the deficient performance came in, because he fell below that standard of attorneys ordinarily practicing in this area with ordinary skill level. He was not aware of that third option. If you look at cases by this court and the Supreme Court, we have Santabella, which was 71, Burge was 2002, Gonzalez, Aguagua, or however you say that one, was 2003, where this court did discuss, and the U.S. Supreme Court did discuss, how there ought to be options when you have a material breach of the agreement.
Counsel, was there any content of the pre-sentence report that purported to originate from the prosecutor? In other words, the prosecutor recommends, or I talked to the probation officer saying, I talked to the prosecutor and the prosecutor said, or is it all we're dealing with in the PSR is the probation officer's recommendation?
That is a good question. It would be uncommon for the prosecutor to be taking a position or a prosecutor's position to be contained in the written document of the pre-sentence investigation. When I reviewed it, I don't recall seeing anything in there. I think that would have raised a red flag for me. The prosecutor did, however, at the time of the sentencing hearing, did indicate, and I'm quoting from this court's opinion 4 years ago, I'll just go through the whole thing. I'm covering the case for, and it has in parentheticals, the prosecutor who had previously appeared in the case, who is on military leave right now. With regard to the matter, he wanted the court to know the state's position is stated in the PSI, and we would submit on the PSI. I had the opportunity to speak with the victim and the victim's family. They will rest on the documentation they provided to the court at this point. So to answer your question, I'm not certain right now if the documentation they provided to the court was contained within the pre-sentence investigation before the sentencing hearing, made a part of the record, or the PSI. At the time, you know, a lot of times at the sentencing hearing, the court will take whatever documentation is submitted and make it a part of the pre-sentence investigation. I just can't recall if that's how that happened.
Now, you're not contending, I don't think, that documentation from the victim or victim's family that's submitted to the probation officer would be a violation of the plea bargain, correct?
Not unless the state would adopt a position of a victim.
Okay.
Say, well, we agree with the victim. This individual needs...
So, but for the comments at sentencing, there's nothing in the PSR itself that is a red flag of a violation of the state's plea bargain.
Not to my knowledge.
All right. Thank you.
So, I think this court can find as a matter of law that defense counsel, trial counsel, was deficient. So we have the breach, we have the prejudice, and we have deficient performance. I think we have all that is needed to show that he received ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think the proper thing to do for this court would be to send it back and give Mr. Sijic the option, put him back in that place if the defense and trial counsel had objected. Now he's back in a position to choose between the options.
With the same judge or with a different judge?
Well, that's a good question. Number one, the same judge has retired.
Well, the post-conviction judge.
Post-conviction judge.
And while we're there, what was the reason the post-conviction judge, what was the reason finding that there was no relief granted?
Governor, I'm out of time. Would you allow me to answer that question?
Yes.
My opinion is the judge focused on the wrong thing. The judge gave weight to the trial counsel's deposition, where trial counsel said this is a very common thing, where prosecutors will agree to stand silent. It wasn't a major part of the plea negotiation. The major part was the reduction classification of the criminal charge. So I think that was where the focus was, finding no material breach. And then under the cloud of, well, the proceedings weren't fundamentally unfair under the situation, but the district court rested on.
Has your client already taken a position that he wants that third option?
He did at the district court level, and that was part of the situation.
So is he bound by that now?
I don't know.
The third option, you're talking about specific performance?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Love, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. George Love on behalf of the appellee, State of Nebraska. All that we've been talking about in this case, both in the original direct appeal case and in the present case, comes under the umbrella of the Strickland test. That, my way of thinking, is integral to any decision in this case. We don't get to stand here today and look back and say, he should have. That's not the review. The review is to stand there at the time that this event occurred from counsel's point of view and decide whether or not his performance was deficient and whether that performance prejudiced the appellant. I submit, based on the evidence, that the district court's findings of fact, A, are supported by the record, B...
What were his findings, the court's findings of fact?
That the findings of fact based upon the statements of the defendant. Do you want me to go lay out the facts, or do you just want me to summarize, Your Honor?
Well, did the court make findings of fact?
Well, of course it did. It found, based upon the evidence, that Mr. Sizdik, I think that's the pronunciation, the appellant, didn't think that that was an integral part of the agreement, didn't ask to withdraw his plea, and it was the only counsel on appeal that advanced that position. The lawyer that he had at the time, at the trial level, said it was common practice to submit on the PSI. If it is common practice to submit on the PSI, not objecting to that could not have been deficient performance. And counsel also stated that agreement to stand silent was not an integral part. It was of the plea agreement. The material part was the reduction in the charge to reduce his exposure on the sentencing of the criminal act. That was the huge, as he testified in deposition, that was the huge part of the plea agreement. So from his point of view, standing there and looking forward, when the prosecution says we submitted on the pre-sentence report, or PSI, pre-sentence investigation, we submitted on that, that's common practice. Had he objected, would that have made any difference?
But didn't we on the direct appeal determine that there was a material breach?
And that's my point. You're looking at it from a pure agreement.
I think what you're trying to say is there's some strategic reason why he didn't object. Is that what you're
That's
saying?
Exactly right. Okay. That's exactly right, and the record supports that. And that's my point. from a strictly legal, analytical, let's not take the Strickland standard into account, even if you call that a legal material breach, the context of that breach comes under the umbrella of Strickland. And you have to look at that and say, is it really a material breach based upon the agreement, the view of counsel, custom practice in the jurisdiction, and the other reasons he gave? It was not a big part of the agreement.
But what was the counsel's testimony from his deposition? One, he didn't determine, he didn't think that it was a material breach, and two, what was the other reason?
Well, first of all, he said it was common practice for the state to submit the matter on the PSI. So if it's common practice, he couldn't be deficient. He did not believe that there was a material breach of the plea agreement, i.e., the fact that the standing silent was not a major part of the plea agreement. What was a major part of
it? We said there was a material breach. Did we not on the direct appeal?
Pardon me?
Yes, that's
absolutely right. You said there was a material breach of the plea agreement. But the point of view is when you're looking at the Strickland standard, as the court says, it's you have to watch the, what did they call that, the, you have to look at it, a fair assessment of the attorney performance required that every effort be made to eliminate the distorting effects of hindsight. So if it's a material breach, fine. That's what the court found as a legal conclusion.
So but we set it back to see if there was any strategy involved here. And then doesn't the evidence show that defense counsel said, I wasn't aware of this third option?
I don't know that that's fundamentally critical here. I don't know that that changes the outcome.
So your argument is there's no prejudice?
That's correct. And I think you could also find there's actually no deficient performance. Because the conduct is to be evaluated from the counsel's perspective at the time. That's a Strickland standard. Not from what we think today, looking back, what should have happened, maybe we should do this. No. It's from him standing in the court at the time, what was the deficient performance, and what was the prejudice? And I submit, I don't think there's either. But even if you accept the idea that it's a material breach,
haven't we already said that?
The prejudice is he didn't get the benefit of the bargain, did he?
But under Santabello, is that benefit an integral part of the bargain? And the answer is no, not based on this evidence. And that's what you have to go by. It's not the court's point of view, it's counsel's point of view. At the time. That's why looking back, when we're standing here today, looking back can be somewhat dangerous
If counsel would have objected, he would have had the alternative of getting a specific performance.
And
instead of the sentence that he got, possibly he may have got something less.
So you're saying his trial strategy was incorrect?
Incorrect as a matter of law.
I disagree. I respectfully disagree that his choice was not to object for very specific reasons, and that is that the reduction of the charge was the integral part of the plea agreement. He did not want to expose his client to the possibility of going to trial on a Class 2 felony. That's all he said. He didn't account for the three prongs that this court has decided that are maybe a remedy in a breach of plea agreement type situation. He just said, I didn't want to do that. That's good reasoning. In fact, that was the argument I made in front of this court on direct appeal. We don't know what his thoughts were. That's why we can't reach that ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And it turns out, I, being a former prosecutor, he didn't want to expose his client to a possibility of 30 more years in prison. And I think that's valid. And I think from the counsel's point of view at the time, looking forward, what is the prejudice to the appellant?
I think you're saying even if trial counsel's reasoning was flawed, the defendant suffered no prejudice.
That's correct.
Is that right?
That's exactly right. Because you're looking at it under the umbrella of an ineffective claim. In other words, the theory that you're looking at is deficient performance prejudice, not the legal conclusion, material breach, ergo counsel, as performance is deficient and prejudicial. Uh-uh. Not from counsel's point of view at the time. So I think
how much would the prosecutor's statement that it supports the pre-sentence report have influenced the trial court in entering its sentence?
Your Honor, I only caught about half of that. I'm sorry.
All right. How much influence would the prosecutor's statement that the state supported the pre-sentence report have influenced the trial court in entering its sentence, as opposed to the prosecutor saying nothing?
Well, and I can only speculate on that, Your Honor, but I can certainly tell you in my experience that while I think the court listens to both sides at the sentencing phase, most courts have already decided what the sentence is going to be when they walk in the door.
Well, don't they look at the pre-sentence report?
Certainly they do. I'm not saying they don't consider all of the facts.
Isn't that what the court typically relies upon?
Absolutely.
In making a sentence, and not whether the prosecutor says we don't support the report or we do support the report?
I think it's a part of it. I don't think it's all of it. I think the court will consider counsel's arguments, both defense and prosecution, during the sentencing phase, so I don't think it's all of it by any stretch. If there are no other questions, excuse me, we'd ask to confirm the district court's order finding that there were no questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal? We have no time for rebuttal, so we will go to the next case of the day, which is State versus Frederick A. Collins, Jr. Ms. Warwick.
Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning to you.
Hey, please, the court.